This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Dr. Heather Ann Thompson about her recent article on mass incarceration in Socialism and Democracy.
The special issue is entitled The Roots of Mass Incarceration in the United States, Locking Up Black Dissidents and Punishing the Poor. The issue was edited and introduced by Mumia Abu-Jamal and Johanna Fernandez.
We'll hear excerpts from a recent press conference at the Center for Constitutional Rights announcing the filing of a lawsuit on behalf of Professor Salaita.
This is the biggest free speech academic case to come along in 50 years.
We'll talk about the Syriza Party's historic victory in Greece.
After mass demonstrations, huge governmental building occupations, and more than 30 general strikes over the last 6 years, the movement in Greece has coalesced and been organized by the Syriza Party. It's an historic time with ramifications not only for Greece, but for Spain, Scotland, and possibly the rest of Europe.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Fyodor Dostoevsky observed that, quote, the degree of civilization in a society can be judged by entering its prisons. Our guest, Dr. Heather Ann Thompson, reports in her recent article, Lessons from Attica, From Prisoner Rebellion to Mass Incarceration and Back, that by 2011, the U.S. was confining nearly 2.5 million persons in state, federal, local, juvenile, and other prisons, including military prisons, immigration detention facilities, civil commitment centers, and prisons in the U.S. territories. Dr. Thompson examines how the carceral state grew to these proportions. Specifically, she outlines the role of the 1971 Attica prison rebellion in challenging what she calls state prerogatives to manage prisons without regard to humanity. Dr. Thompson joins us today to talk about her work and her upcoming book on the first comprehensive history of the Attica prison rebellion. Heather, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
We were delighted to read your article, Lessons from Attica, From Prisoner Rebellion to Mass Incarceration and Back in Socialism and Democracy. And we wanted to start by asking you, in your opinion, how did the system get to where we are with such an epidemic number of persons incarcerated in this country?
Well, that's a wonderful question, and it's, I think, the reason why it's so important to really examine the broader history of prisons and criminal justice in our country, because, you know, trying to explain how we became the world's outlier with so many incarcerated and such a, you know, hugely disproportionate number of those people being persons of color, we have a lot to explain. And for me, when I began to work on a book on the Attica Rebellion, it, you know, began to just occur to me. I mean, in some ways, it's embarrassing to think back and think, why didn't it occur to me sooner? But, you know, something very clearly happened after the 1960s to our criminal justice system, and even more specifically after 1971 in our criminal justice system. And clearly, it had a lot to do with the rebellions of that period. Now, sorting all that out is what I've been doing since and for the last little decade. But in short, one way to think about it is that just like had happened after the Civil War, when, you know, sort of the first moment of great civil rights unrest in this country, when we had 4 million newly freed African Americans, you know, demanding a real voice in our society, meaningful equality in our society, the response of that society, in that case in the South, was to change all the laws, to all of a sudden criminalize black spaces in new ways. And almost overnight, Southern prison institutions not only exploded in population, but they went from being all white to all black. Well, you fast forward to the 1960s, and I think something really similar to that happens. We have enormous civil rights unrest. When it's first in the South, Northern politicians can sort of say, oh, well, you know, that's great, that's fine, you know, those Southern racists deserve it. But then the movement comes north, and it comes not just to cities like Detroit or Philadelphia or wherever, but it also erupts in penal institutions. And then the stakes get much higher, and many northern politicians begin to conflate urban protest and unrest at, you know, the slow pace of civil rights, equality, and gains with crime, and began a war on crime, actually, in 1964 with Lyndon Johnson, before there was either a historically unusual or even immediately impressive rise in crime. And, you know, one can only see this as very much a reaction to that rebellion in places like Attica, but also on the streets.
Heather, talk about the various rebellions. You mentioned not only various prisons, but various extraordinary prisoners who fought back. And I thought that was a really moving part of your article. Talk to us about that, please.
Well, I mean, while we know in American history a great deal about civil rights icons on the outside, we know about the Malcolm X's and the Martin Luther King's and you know, Fannie Lou Hamer's and so forth, we, I think, need to know much more about the people that were inside prison walls making very similar arguments and fighting equal battles, if not more difficult battles, because they were confined so much more acutely. Whether that was someone like George Jackson, who, you know, had been immediately, you know, arrested on a very minor crime, and because he'd been given an indefinite sentence, literally could not, indeterminate sentence, couldn't get out of prison, and every time he spoke up, got more time. These men like him were writers and thinkers, and they began to articulate a real critique of the American prison system as, you know, part and parcel of what was happening on the outside, a real reflection of what was happening on the outside. And, you know, that awoke people. It touched people. It made them see the circumstances that they faced not as individual failings, but as a broader systemic problem with the society, that it chose to lock up and criminalize the people that it would rather not employ or deal with on an equal ground.
Can you talk a bit about what the prisoners' rights movement looked like in the 60s and 70s? Because you say that the work that took place then was an important part of sort of staving off a larger kind of control on the part of state officials.
Right. Well, what I tried to do in this particular article was make the point that what happened in the American prison system that we see today, that kind of what seems to be ultimate control, you know, the ultimate punitive penal state, that incarcerated folks understood exactly that that's what was at stake well before it became a reality. They understood, whether they were prisoners in Angola in the South or prisoners in Attica in upstate New York, they understood that unchecked power of a prison system was draconian and dangerous and brutal, and particularly to people of color. Because they understood that, that is where the wellspring of resistance, you know, that was the wellspring of resistance. This is why people were willing to risk so much to fight back for basic things, right? Like, you know, the ability to be educated, the ability to be paid for your forced labor in prison so that you would have money to live in prison and be able to support your community outside of prison, things like this. They fought for those things, or basic human rights like the ability to not be locked in solitary confinement indefinitely. Because they understood that a prison system left unchecked would become even more inhumane than it was. So rebellions like Attica were very much about saying, we are men, we are not beasts, as L.D. Barclay said. It was about putting the state on notice that, you know, as human beings, you cannot treat us, no matter what, you know, what we may have done or what you say that we did, you still have to treat us as people. And in my piece, I make this point to point out that those rebellions were vital in, you know, putting the state in check. But I also note that the reaction to that, the state reaction to that, we can only understand that as well by understanding what was at stake. In other words, the state also understood that its ability to do exactly what it wanted any time it wanted was being threatened. And the backlash to the Attica Rebellion was horrific.
We're speaking with Heather Ann Thompson, whose article, Lessons from Attica, From Prison Rebellion to Mass Incarceration and Back, is included in the magnificent issue of the magazine Socialism and Democracy. It's a double issue, and it's devoted to the roots of mass incarceration in the U.S., locking up black dissidents and punishing the poor. Heather, talk to us about the Attica Rebellion, because there were many rebellions, as you point out in your article, but the Attica Rebellion really was the most extraordinary and explosive and deadly. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about that, because that really made an impact nationwide.
Right. Well, I mean, the wonderful thing about this particular rebellion is that, you know, there are many, thankfully, many people who were there, remember it, fought on behalf of it around that to this day give us that history and testify as to its importance. One of the long-standing lawyers in the case, Elizabeth Fink, you know, fought this battle on behalf of the Attica brothers for, you know, decades and decades. And, you know, these are the people that are the real repository of that history. But in my role as a scholar, what I tried to do was to rescue for the American public some of those hidden histories that maybe people there knew but the public did not know, and namely that, you know, you had a four-day congregating of, you know, thousands, nearly 1,300 men inside of a penal institution that were willing to stand together, overwhelmingly black, but you know, black, Puerto Rican, white, and say to the state, we will negotiate with you logically and in good faith to try to improve the conditions under which we live. And to do that, they brought in observers to kind of help oversee things, in other words, to make sure that the state would bargain in good faith. They had media there, so this was one of the only televised rebellions from inside of a penal institution. And most importantly, these men articulated themselves exactly why this prison system was inhumane, why it was particularly inhumane for prisoners of color, and were very clear what needed to happen to that system to become more humane. They weren't arguing that they should be freed. They weren't arguing that they, you know, any of the things that the state would later try to portray. They just wanted to be heard. And what made it so really remarkable was that the world's attention was focused on it. Everybody was watching Attica. They had taken hostages, but they had protected those hostages, surrounded them with, you know, several rings of prisoners to make sure that they were protected and fed. And indeed, the hostages themselves said to the state of New York, you know, work with these guys, you know, give them what they need, because the hostages knew what was at stake also. I mean, I think that's what's so remarkable about Attica. Everybody understood what was at stake. And what was at stake was ultimate prison power. And so the negotiation went on, and it appeared that they were going to be able to get many of the things that they had asked for. But ultimately, the state of New York was unwilling to give in on the most important demand, which was amnesty. Amnesty for, once they surrendered, so that they would not be charged with any riot-related crimes that the state would allege that they had committed, and an assurance that they would not have reprisals, that they would not be not pay a high price for having done this rebellion. That, because, again, they knew from other rebellions at places like Auburn Prison, and certainly it had happened in other prisons in the South and the North, that the swift reaction of the state could be brutal once someone had dared to speak back. So they wanted assurances. And, you know, the state was just simply unwilling to budge on this. Even the observers, you know, men like Tom Wicker from the New York Times, or Republican State Senator John Dunn, or famed, you know, lawyer Bill Kunstler, all said to Rockefeller, the governor at the time, you've got to come here. You know, you don't need to meet with the prisoners, but you need to stand outside here, and you need to assure them that this is, that you're going to stand by these demands, that you're going to make sure they're all right if they surrender. And he simply wouldn't. And instead, he made the decision that he was going to send in, you know, hundreds of state troopers who had been out on the lawn for days with no sleep, furious, being fueled with rumors of atrocities going on inside. By the way, rumors that were in no small part fueled by FBI folks who were, you know, saying complete lies like, the inmates are standing the hostages at attention and threatening to kill one of them every minute, and, you know, things like this.
Well, they castrated
was later. This is before. That rumor came about after they retook the prison. Yeah. So they retook the prison in an utter brutal fashion, mowed down people, first with tear gas and then with guns, bullets, handguns, deer slug bullets, shotguns, killing scores of people, wounding scores of people, and then realizing the kind of bloodbath, state officials stood outside of the prison and told the world, and it really was the world because there was media from everywhere, that the prisoners are the ones who had killed the hostages, and from then on just tried to control the story, cover up what had really happened, and then that began the, you know, really now 40-year saga of trying to tell the truth of what had happened at Attica.
Heather, this is slightly beyond the scope of your article, but I'd be interested to hear your insights about how the privatization of our prisons will impact what you call these powerful lessons that rebellions such as Attica and others can teach us. Does it complicate the prospect for reform in our penal institutions?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. I mean, just first let me say, to be clear, you know, in this article, for those who might not have read it, the lesson that I wanted to make clear, the lesson from Attica was not actually that the state would be all triumphant, or that, you know, that the rebellion had been a disaster because so much brutality and mass incarceration had followed. It was actually rather to say, Attica makes clear what the stakes are, but Attica also indicates what the power of resistance is, right? It also makes clear that it makes a difference when people stand together and demand change and demand better treatment. So in that light, when you think about the current system that is becoming increasingly privatized, particularly as states are, you know, collapsing under the weight of the cost of mass incarceration that they have created, it is alarming, because to the extent that there is any transparency in a state system, which of course there's also very little, I mean, we can't, for example, tell you how many hours of solitary confinement or days or months or years state prisoners have served in the United States in the last 12 months. We don't have that data. But we know a lot more about the state prison system. It is more transparent by far than these private prisons are. And so it is alarming. It's also alarming because even people who work in private prisons have little power. That is to say, the employees, the corrections officers, because they're not unionized, they too are kind of subjected to this privatized world where the company can do whatever it wants. So it's not good. But on the other hand, resistance is resistance. And when people stand together, as they did recently in the most shut-down facility you can imagine, which is Pelican Bay in California, where people are in solitary, locked away from each other and the world 23-plus hours a day, they managed to pull off a deeply important hunger strike. And those things matter because, again, at the end of the day, incarceration is about human beings. And so when human beings do speak up and do call attention to what goes on behind these closed walls, private or otherwise, they have some power.
We're speaking with Heather Ann Thompson, who wrote Lessons from Attica, From Prisoner Rebellion to Mass Incarceration and Back, in the issue of Socialism and Democracy, which is called The Roots of Mass Incarceration in the U.S., Locking Up Black Dissidents and Punishing the Poor. Heather, if you would give me permission, I'd like to ask you a personal question, if it's okay. I'd like to know how a scholar like yourself got involved in these kinds of issues. What was it that led you to write this contribution to the magazine?
Well, fair enough. I, you know, came to this question not as a historian of prisons or crime and punishment, although that seems to be what I now am. I came to it as a civil rights historian, someone who was really interested in struggles for civil rights in cities. So my first book was about Detroit and about the rebellion of 67 in Detroit and all of the battles that then went on in that city and in those auto plants to make things better for Black Detroiters. That's how I came to Attica. I saw it as this amazing episode of civil rights rebellion, and I wanted to know more about it. But again, then, had I not met people like Elizabeth Fink who could help me understand this story, and had I not spent 10 years digging in every nook and cranny to try to uncover the story, this would have been a difficult story to tell, because the state has gone to enormous lengths to keep a lid on it. I mean, I'm still battling with state officials on getting access to, just through freedom of information, things that should be easily revealed. So then it became a much more to me about trying to understand the prison system. And then again, as I mentioned earlier, it dawned on me, wow, and here we sit today with the most draconian, largest prison system in the world. What in the world happened? How did we get there? And so while working on Attica, I became a scholar who really tried to understand the origins of mass incarceration and its impact in American cities and on our American democracy. Other things I've written have been how it's distorted our democracy and so forth. So I came at it sort of sideways. But once you see the impact that the American criminal justice system has on everything else, once you understand American history through that lens, it's very difficult to then shift your gaze. You can't lock up and keep under correctional control nearly 7 million people and, you know, have 62 million people with some form of a criminal record in a society and not ask, how does that then shape everything else in our country?
Your forthcoming book on Attica, what is the title of that again?
Well, of course, until it's on shelves, I can't promise the title, but so far it is called Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. And it is a book that will, I hope, take readers from 1970 all the way up to the present day to try to tell every bit of that rebellion, but also the really, you know, decades-long battles of the survivors to get justice for what had happened on September 13th, 1971, and what it has meant for our current criminal justice system.
You have our assurance that Heidi and I and Michael will do everything we can to spread the word on your book once it comes out.
Heather, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder, and we look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, good luck. Bring you now to a press conference held live in New York City at the Center for Constitutional Rights. The center is representing Professor Stephen Salida. Salida was hired and then discharged before he could start his job last summer at the University of Illinois. He was hired by the American Indian Studies program there after a thorough vetting. After Israel attacked Gaza, where some 2,000 people were killed, including 500 children, Salida tweeted several what was termed uncivil messages on his Twitter account. This was brought to the attention of Zionist donors to the University of Illinois, who then pressured Chancellor Phyllis Wise to rescind the hiring. Professor Salida's case is probably the most important case in 50 years. Not since the 60s, when the Supreme Court overturned the non-communist loyalty oath, has an issue of this importance arisen. Some 6,000 professors have vowed to boycott the University of Illinois. A point has been made that preventing Salida from working is the same thing as preventing people who are alleged communists or socialists from working. We go now to the Center for Constitutional Rights press conference.
Anand Swaminathan of Lovi & Lovi will now discuss the filing, and then Professor Salida will say a few words. Thank you.
Hello. Today, in the United States District Court in Chicago, we filed a lawsuit on Professor Salida's behalf against the Board of Trustees of the University of Illinois and against Chancellor Phyllis Wise, President Robert Easter, Vice President Christopher Pierre, and 8 of the 9 members of the Board of Trustees. The first set of claims in this lawsuit are that the university and its top officials violated Professor Salida's constitutional rights in 2 important ways. First, they violated his First Amendment right to free speech by firing him for his political speech. that is, for having opinions they did not like on an important public issue. Second, they violated his 14th Amendment right to due process of law by summarily stripping him of a tenured position without any notice or opportunity to be heard. The lawsuit also alleges that after obtaining Professor Salaita's acceptance of an offer and preparing for Professor Salaita's arrival on campus, such as scheduling him to begin teaching courses in the fall, the university breached its contract and promised to complete Professor Salaita's appointment to the faculty. Finally, the lawsuit also brings claims against financial donors who sought to inject themselves into the university hiring process by demanding that the university break its commitment to Professor Salaita or else they would stop donating to the university. Those donors have not yet been identified because of the university's refusal to reveal the administration's communications with donors in response to Freedom of Information requests. I want to turn now from the claims in the lawsuit to the evidence. First, what Professor Salaita does not need to prove, that the university fired him based on his tweets about Israel and Palestine during the Gaza conflict. Everyone, including the university, acknowledges that Professor Salaita's tweets were the reason for his firing. The administration's justification is that it was not the content or viewpoint of those tweets that caused his firing, but the uncivil tone of his tweets. But we will show that justification is unlawful under Supreme Court precedent. We will also show that other arguments that officials have made are plainly pretextual. For example, the charge that Professor Salaita may not be a fair teacher are demonstrably disproven by his stellar teacher evaluations, evidence that was readily available to anyone that cared to look. We intend to prove that the true motivation for the university's hasty decision was pressure from donors. Everything that the university has done since it announced its decision further confirms that improper motivation. The university says publicly that its decision was not based on donor pressure, yet it refuses to comply with the Freedom of Information requests of Professor Salaita and others for communications with donors. If the university is to be believed, why won't it and others, release that information? The university's own Committee on Academic Freedom has made unequivocally clear that the university violated principles of academic freedom, shared faculty governance, and the university's own policies, and that justification for firing Professor Salaita, his uncivil tone, is a gross violation of principles of academic freedom and should be withdrawn. Yet, the university has refused to follow the committee's recommendation to revisit its decision. If donor pressure was not the motivation, then why won't the university follow the recommendation of respected faculty and even allow qualified academic experts to weigh in? In sum, the university administration has made claims that are contradicted by its actions. Through this lawsuit, we will put the administration's claims to the test. In the process, we hope to vindicate Professor Salaita and obtain a ruling that will allow him to join his colleagues in American Indian Studies, and in the process, help the university community get answers about how its administration thinks and operates.
Hello, everybody. This is Steve Salaita. The university's actions have caused me significant economic, emotional, and reputational damage and have taken a significant toll on my family. The firing has left my academic career, the primary mechanism for supporting my family, in shambles. Obtaining a lifetime tenured faculty position at a major American university, a product of years of study and scholarship, represented the pinnacle achievement of my professional career. This ordeal not only cost me that achievement, but I lost my prior tenured position, and the University of Illinois' defamatory attacks have made it impossible for me to obtain a tenured position at another university. I'm now jobless, and without a university affiliation, my ability to publish articles in academic journals and to present scholarship to colleagues is severely diminished. Without an income source, my wife, young son, and I have been forced to move in with my parents and now struggle to make ends meet. I deeply miss being in the classroom, where I always learned from students in addition to teaching them. My primary motivation in bringing this suit is to join my colleagues in the American Indian Studies program at UIUC and begin teaching. If the university is able to ignore its own rules and terminate a tenured faculty member for acts of extramural speech, it will have serious negative repercussions on academic freedom, faculty governance, student learning, and intellectual exchange. I do not want UIUC's illegal actions to become the norm in American universities. I have long sought to resolve this matter amicably and cooperatively without the need for a lawsuit. We bring this suit only after the university made it clear that it had no intention to follow the recommendation of its own Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure to allow a body of qualified experts within the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences to review the matter and determine whether my appointment to the faculty should be completed. Though it bears repeating that qualified academic bodies already rigorously vetted my teaching and scholarship during the year-long application process. I am grateful to folks of all political stripes who have offered support and to my colleagues in and beyond American Indian Studies at UIUC who have encouraged me to keep going and have kept my position open. I look forward to joining them on the faculty.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Last week, in an historic election, the Greek people voted in the anti-austerity party of Syriza, led by Alexis Tsipras, winning 149 seats of the 300-seat Greek parliament. In the previous 8 years, the Greek people have demonstrated massively, occupied government buildings, and gone on more than 30 general strikes. Now they've formed a party to take power in government, to effectuate a program that will call for cancellation of debt, nationalization of the banks, and expropriating closed factories. Will their attempt to alleviate the misery of much of the Greek population succeed? We'll see. We're joined by Dan Georgiakis, a regular columnist for the National Herald, the leading Greek-American weekly newspaper, a fellow of the American Hellenic Institute, and the co-author of Detroit, I Do Mind Dying, and co-editor of Solidarity Forever, an oral history of the IWW. Dan has taught at NYU, City University of New York, the Van Arsdale Labor College, Columbia, and the University of Oklahoma.
Dan Georgiakis, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Pleased to be here.
We'd like to start by painting a picture of everyday life in Greece for older people, public workers, young people. What has austerity meant for them?
Austerity means, I think for Americans, think of the Great Depression, but it's worse. 26% unemployment for at least 3 or 4 years. 60% unemployment for people under 30, which has caused 200,000 college graduates to leave the country in the last 2 years. Greece had the lowest pensions in the EU, and that pension system has been cut between a third and a half. Wages, which were the lowest in Europe, have been cut about a third. That's if you have a job. Remember, there's 26 unemployment rate. Prices in Greece are about the same as the EU level elsewhere, so you're getting less and less money for the same priced goods. 300,000 businesses failed as of 2013, probably more since then. Now, what austerity then does, having taken away people's money, is raise the property tax and raise the gas and electric taxes and made it so that the government collects those taxes. When you go to pay your gas tax, that's when you got to pay your income tax also. People in Greece generally own their own homes, and you have the situation now where people have to sell a house which they already own because they can't pay the property taxes. So it's pretty bad. And one of the things in the past when Greeks have had the difficulty is the children go back and move in with their parents, but now that's not possible because of the cost of the house, and prices are just so high and there's just no money. So it's a pretty desperate situation. Food lines, there's been a mass movement from the bottom. There's one situation in Greece where they have set up a food co-op where the farmers come in and sell directly to the customer, and it turns out that the farmer gets 25% more than he would at the supermarket, and the customer gets 25% less. So there's lots of movement like that in society. The Greek Orthodox Church has opened a lot of soup lines and kitchen lines and things of that nature.
I know, it's just striking. We read about the homelessness, the suicides, the high infant mortality rate.
Yeah. There was a point in which medicines were so scarce that people with chronic disease like heart disease and so forth, they could do fine with the proper medication, couldn't get the medication because the drug companies wouldn't sell to the Greek pharmacies because the pharmacies didn't have enough money and they wouldn't give them a loan.
And in response to this, we've been reading for years about the general strikes in Greece, about the mass governmental building occupations, demonstrations. It was just a society in turmoil, but there was no political formation that could really mold it and take power. And that's all changed now with the winning of the Syriza party in parliament and taking control of the government. Talk to us, Dan, will you, about the Syriza party. Where did it come from? Who's in it? What does it represent? How did they win the election? Give our audience an idea of what we're talking about here.
Well, Syriza came, people say it comes out of nowhere. Not quite. There are a lot of small left-wing parties in Greece. And in fact, the Greeks have been writing almost every election since the 1970s, 50% of the people voted for a socialist party of one kind or another. But they were scattered all over, so they never really could make a majority of any kind. What Syriza did was put together a coalition of left parties. That was very difficult to do because within the coalition there are Trotskyists, there are Eurocommunists, there are old PASOKs, environmentalists, anarcho-syndicalists, and so forth. And so getting to all those people into one room and agreeing on a program is not a very easy thing to do. But Syriza itself isn't there for a traditional party. It is a coalition of parties which probably will transform in time perhaps into a coherent party. But the people have all are very serious. I would say that the activists are quite radical compared to the voters. Not that the voters don't know who the activists are, but the activists are very conscious about political history, and if you sit down and talk with them, everybody's very learned about the history of the last 100 years. And I would say if anything characterizes the profile of Syriza, it's very anti-Stalinist. It wants to go from the base up, and it talks a lot about horizontalism and things of that nature, which really fit into the general radical temperament of our times, I think.
Talk about their 40-point program and outline what they're trying to accomplish, and how does that hit home for us in the United States?
As far as their program is concerned, it's quite modest. What they say is they're so far behind, and it's such a weak economy that it's going to take decades to repair. So on the one hand, in the minds of the leadership is that capitalism and prosperity are incompatible. But you can't go from where you are today to a true socialist society. You have to go in steps. And so their steps they want to take are very modest, beginning reversing some of the changes, some of the cuts that were made in the past, and beginning to deal with the tremendous corruption and waste of money in the government. If they could clean up government, and I can give you some examples, that would be, do a great thing toward helping the debt crisis. Syriza also has a broad Euro view of the world. It believes that it is the cutting edge and that other movements will emerge and already are emerging in the rest of Europe, which will change the whole dynamics of Europe, which then Greece will benefit because it is a relatively small economy. So they have a very close relationship with Podemos in Spain, and even parties like the Greens in the UK are very enthusiastic about Syriza, and the Greens are the fastest growing party in the UK, and it looks like Labour will not be able to win a majority in the next election, in which case the Greens and or the leftist Scottish Nationalist Party will have to form a coalition with Labour. So what Syriza sees is things like that happening all over Europe, and the whole general austerity regime and the setback to socialist change will be reversed. And that's their longer-term plan. And when you look at the 40 points for Greece, it's like building blocks toward that bigger vision. And, of course, the critics in the left will say, well, they're just a reformist party. They could stop at any time with these reforms. The answer to that that Syriza would give is that, no, we're not going to stop. We're just going to keep going and building, but you got to build brick by brick.
I read an article by Ed Rooksby, who concluded on that point, Dan, which, and I think his sentence is worth repeating. He says, revolutionary social change must come from ordinary people's collective experience of the way in which modest common sense demands and measures to improve their lives and defend their dignity run up against the limits of what the current order will allow. And I think there's a certain dynamic to that. Talk to us about what Tsipras has been able to do so far. What are the first few things he did? He's been in office now for several days. And what's happened?
Well, he did several things that I consider to be brilliant. First thing, his coalition partner. He's too short of having a complete control of the government. So the question is, which party would he go with? And instead of going with a centrist or mildly socialist party, he went with Enel, which is a populist right-wing party, which seems to be a strange mix, but it really isn't, because this party is very strongly anti-austerity and very hostile to the Germans. So on that basis, they're on basic agreement on the economics, and on social issues, they're just going to agree to disagree. And I thought a little bit about Ralph Nader saying sometimes the left and the right can cooperate on certain issues and agree to disagree on others. So I thought that was an interesting choice. Also indicates a little bit like we're not so crazy and inflexible that we just can't deal with people with different points of view. Second thing he did, same day he was inaugurated, he went to Kasteriani, which is a place where 300 Greeks were massacred by the Nazis as they were departing Athens. It's a well-known massacre in Greece. Most of the people massacred were communists or resistance fighters. And so by going there after being sworn in as prime minister and laying a rose and so forth on the graves, he really served notice on the Germans that the days of our kowtowing to you and being bullied are really over, and don't you dare call us pigs anymore. Very strong reaction in Greece, very positive reaction to that symbolic moment.
Well, it's the German banks that were lending the money to keep Greece afloat. And it's
we can talk about
we
that.
We should talk about that.
They lend money to keep Germany afloat, to tell you the truth. But we'll get back in a minute. Third thing he did was he took the oath of he's a declared atheist, and he refused to have the archbishop at the swearing-in ceremony. So he became the first prime minister in Greek history to be sworn in as a in a strictly secular setting, which is very important because the Greek church owns a lot of property in Greece. There's all kinds of tax shenanigans that go on there. And Greece's church is established to the degree that it controls some of the curriculum. So I don't think that's going to be their first order of business, but he clearly was saying, this is not the same old, same old. Fourth thing he did, which I'm surprised that the Wall Street Journal and the rest haven't talked about, is when he created his cabinet, he's eliminated some of the bigger cabinet posts and consolidated part of the Greek bureaucracy. So on the first day of office, or the second day of office, he's already, quote, shrinking the government, but shrinking it in a way that the Troika didn't anticipate necessarily. In other words, recognizing there's all the kind of horrible bureaucracy in Greece, and that, we can get rid of a lot of these ministries. It isn't the civil servant who's working on the desk downstairs. It's the whole apparatus behind it. And the fifth thing, which is more subtle, is Syriza has made a big approach to the diaspora. They have chosen several candidates that they ran and who won were people who were living abroad, some Americans, some people from England, and so forth. And before the election, speaking to the largest Greek-American newspaper, he said that the time for the diaspora to be extras is over. We want you to be comrades in arms. And one of the things he wants to do, he says it's repugnant to him that Greek citizens living abroad cannot vote in Greek elections, the only European country that has that ruling. And they're going to change that, which will also be to their benefit because most of the expatriate vote would have gone to Syriza. Now, these are first 2 or 3 days in office, and he's shown a direction and the flexibility, a mixture of being practical and being symbolic, which I think is very promising. People who contact me from Greece said people are euphoric in Athens, just euphoric.
Dan, this is heartening, but what obstacles do you think lay in the immediate future? Can this momentum be kept up?
Going to come into conflict with domestic capital, with European capital. We're afraid of capital flight, of bank runs, withdrawal of international corporations. I mean, what do you think is going to happen?
The Eurozone has to decide what it wants to be. If it's going to be a German monarchy, so to speak, in which the North completely exploits the South, that's not viable. So therefore, they're going to make demands on the EU to change these rates. First of all, they're going to try and get the rates reduced and then the time of payments reduced and then some of that's absolutely canceled. They believe they can do that because if the Eurozone doesn't do that, then Greece will in fact be forced out of the Eurozone. Not because it exits, because it's forced. That means that this 20-30 year project, even longer than that, to build the Eurozone is really threatened. And they do not believe the Germans and other northern countries like Finland and some others will countenance that, and it's not worth their while not to make some concessions. We already have heard from the Germans that they're willing to make some of these minor concessions. France really wants an end to austerity, and many of the other European countries are saying this austerity of Germany just doesn't make any sense. You know, the Swiss took away their franc from the euro. The Eurobank has lowered interest rates, etc. So in those long-term ways of thinking, Syriza thinks it'll get enough support in Europe and enough relief to be able to do something in Greece. And then by what it does in Greece, will allow them to continue to make their reforms there without facing some of these catastrophic problems that you talk about. Of course, who knows? I mean, so you could have hardliners in the north, but I think Syriza is correct in this, and I think they feel the Greeks were bullied, and they also know that the northerners are quite aware of Greek corruption. For instance, the new finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, in 2003, he and a group of other economists wrote a note with documentations to the EU saying the financial records being sent to you by the Papandreou machine are false. Greece is not ready to join the EU under the conditions that you're supposed to have. And they ignored his memo, the memo of these Greeks. Later on, they denied receiving it, and finally, when they were produced and shown, they said, oh, yeah, well, we really didn't realize how important it was. We know, too, that many of the so-called loans to Greece are really self-serving. For instance, Goldman Sachs, a familiar company in the international world, arranged for the Greeks to enter the EU in the first the Eurozone in the first place by totally fraudulent cash arrangement. They loaned Greece money at a special rate so that Greece could then pay off its debt and look like it was solvent, and then issued new bonds at an even higher rate. Siemens, among others, a German company, has paid over $100 million to Greece for corruption. They said because, oh, there really wasn't any corruption, but we'll just do this to settle it. Well, if they're doing $106 million to prevent litigation, you can imagine how much is actually being stolen. The German submarine, the idea of a German bank, and they loaned Greece 6 million euros. The only thing is that most of the money had to be used to buy German equipment to make the submarine. So the $6 million, in fact, was a loan to Germany by Germany, with Greece paying the interest. Same thing with the Venizelos airport. EU money went in there, but all the equipment and so forth had to be done by German companies. So many of these loans turn out to be very self-serving and are not the loan you think it is. It's not like I've got this money, now I can spend it domestically. It just goes back internationally.
And they've saddled Greece with a huge debt and forced them into this impoverished position to pay it back. That's what we mean by austerity. But one thing I'm concerned about, Dan, is the role of the police in Greece. As I understand that Golden Dawn movement, which is a neo-Nazi movement, has a lot of support in the police force. Do you think that poses a danger to the movement?
It is a potential danger. We know, for instance, because of the way the voting goes down in Greece, that the police vote at their barracks, that 50% of the security police voted for Golden Dawn. So that's given them, Golden Dawn, quite a few free hand in some of the things it has been doing. Now, the Samarasan regime finally took some action against Golden Dawn, and I'm sure that Syriza will follow through. But yes, there's always a problem with the Greek security police, and there's also a potential problem with the military in terms of a coup d'etat. But it does, the coup d'etat from the military does not seem likely, and the for reasons that are usually when those things are happening, everybody kind of knows the buzz is around. For instance, the coup of 67 was very much anticipated by everybody. It just came from the colonels instead of the generals. So the security police are a problem, and we'll see how that's handled. But yes, they are a problem.
I wanted to ask you if our listeners want to follow this story, which we all think is one of the most important things that's gone on in the world lately, how do they follow it? Do you have a website that people can follow your writings on this, or are there other materials available? How do we keep up to date with the developments in Greece?
That's difficult. There is a site called Press Project, which is pretty good. and publishes in English a lot of material on Greece. Well, it's all about Greece. So I recommend that one. And I think that The Guardian, which isn't perfect, does have a fairly decent coverage of Greece. I do not have a personal blog, and I write for a variety of papers, so it's kind of hard for people to just follow me, as it were, if they want to do that. But I don't believe in people following anybody.
One last thing. Where do you think things are going now?
I think the Eurozone will relent and will give Greece some kind of relief. And the question is how well Syriza can then take that moment and work it to the advantage of the Greek people and then go forward with other changes. I'm appalled when people keep talking about the Greek exit and so forth, like the Syriza's anxious to leave the Eurozone. Greeks are not anxious to leave the Eurozone. They're not anxious. They don't want to leave the European Union. As far as the Eurozone is concerned, they don't want to leave it either. And I think that, there will be concessions given to them.
We're all very optimistic about this new development in Greece, and we're thankful to you, Dan Georgiakis, for being on Law & Disorder, and we're going to keep touching base with you and have some more reports on this as it unfolds. Thank you.
Very good, and I thank you for the privilege of talking to so many people.
Bye-bye, Dan. Thank you.
Take care.
If you want to hear Law & Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law & Disorder Radio on Facebook. Thank you.